Hello and welcome to the Glow Journal podcast, a conversation with the beautiful minds behind the world's biggest beauty brands. I'm your host, beauty writer Gemma Diamond, and in this episode, I'm joined by the founder of Hairification, Jordan Mylius. I've always said that this podcast is for lovers of beauty and business, but I'm acutely aware we skew heavily towards the former. Those who listen for the latter are in for a real treat this week. You've heard of Hairification. From a distribution standpoint, they are the fastest growing hair care brand in Australia, having launched into 840 Coles stores in 2023. That is 840 retail locations from day one. And as of last month, hitting the shelves of all 470 Priceline stores. Quick maths, Hairification is available in over 1,300 retail locations less than a year post-launch. Jordan has entered the beauty founder space with a really interesting skill set and perspective. He bought a tanning and beauty salon when he was 21, more or less on a whim, and fell in love with the transformative power of beauty. From there, he's spent about 15 years in the beauty industry, having been poached by Tuscan Tan for his sales skills and spending over 7 years helping to grow Bondi Sands into the best-selling fake tan brand in the world. I'm always fascinated by how a new beauty brand tackles new customer conversion in such a saturated market. And I find that education piece particularly interesting when a brand launches into grocery, a space where most shoppers are purchasing habitually. Jordan's take on this is so interesting, and I respect how honest he is about how difficult that process can be. His approach is clearly working, despite that eye-watering number of retail locations here in Australia. This year, we'll also see the brand expand globally. In this conversation, Jordan shares how he identified a gap in the market and saw an opportunity, why his focus was accessibility as opposed to the luxury beauty sector, and his advice on hiring and why you do often have to start slow and scrappy. Okay, so I did my digging. I've done my due diligence. I know that you've been a part of the beauty industry and a business owner since you were 21, but I want to go back right to the beginning. What is your earliest memory of beauty?
I think it would be with my mum at the hairdresser, strangely enough. Like, she's always having her hair done, whether it be coloured or, you know, the weekly blow wave or whatever it may be, and being quite bored sitting there in that salon with my sister, and both of us knowing not to misbehave, otherwise that would be the end of us. And also just being at home in mum's ensuite and smelling her fragrances and like smelling, I remember there was this, it was a Chanel Coco something fragrance I'd always smell. And looking at
So mum's got taste.
Yeah. And looking at all of her skincare products and, you know, she'd always be like, don't touch them. So that's probably my earliest memory. Yeah. But I don't remember feeling or thinking, oh, yeah, like I'm interested in this. It was, I don't know, maybe just because, you know, things are pretty. Yeah. And as a kid, you just want to touch them and be annoying.
I get it. There's very few things that like touch on all of those senses like beauty. So I get it. I feel like everyone has a pretty visceral memory for that one. So no particularly early interest in beauty. So what did you want to be when you grew up?
I actually wanted to be the most consistent thing I wanted to be, because I think everyone, it changes.
Of course.
I wanted to be a chef, or because I love cooking.
Love.
I'm a savory cook, not a sweet person, because I don't like following a recipe. I like to look at it and then change it up. But that's what I wanted to do. But that was very short lived when I was in year 10 and you have to go out for a week and do work experience. Mm-hmm. And I did it at a big hotel in Melbourne in their kitchen. And after a day, but after about 3 minutes of doing nothing but peeling potatoes and using some machine to mash them, I was like, this is not my idea of fun.
Yeah.
So that was a, yeah, that was an aspiration. I mean, thank goodness for the work experience week.
Seriously.
So, yeah.
Okay, so year 10 work experience is when you decided, okay, the kitchen is not for me professionally. Mm. Where did you go from there? Talk me through the time post deciding you did not want to be a chef and pre getting into the beauty industry.
So I still, in high school, I still studied like hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
So still did the cooking piece. I did like art stuff. Yeah. So photography, I've always liked that. But then also the other end of the spectrum, like English and English literature. By the end of year 12, I could speak Shakespeare fluently.
We have that in common.
And also business management, commerce, yeah, and legal studies. So uh-huh. I did think maybe I wanted to... I actually wasn't sure. I was so unsure, which, like so many people, yeah, I had no idea. And I remember when it came time to applying for universities, which is, you know, you go through those motions. I applied and I got into uni to marketing and PR, I think, which mm-hmm. is definitely not my, you know, love or passion or what I've done.
Yeah.
I got into that at Monash and I deferred for a year.
Yeah.
And decided I just wanted to work. So I got a job in real estate
mm-hmm.
and I was PA to two directors of a large agency, a very successful agency. And so effectively they listed property and I sold their listings and like managed all the in between. And so that was when I really learned how to deal with people,
yes,
and to sell, and that people don't necessarily buy something because they love it. They will, you know, I was dealing with people, you know, making their biggest purchase in their life. They buy from me, the person. And, it was really interesting. Studied a lot of things like body language and all that kind of stuff.
Really?
Yeah, and like the whole emotive side of buying and, you know, how to sell, and then the whole negotiation side of things as well. So that was certainly a great, like, I guess, footing for
There's like a psychology component to
Yes. And my mother is a psychologist as well. So yeah, I was always at home being shrunk.
Oh, this
shrunk.
Is so full circle.
So yeah, that. And I did real estate for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Really loved it. Learned a lot. And just loved the whole, like, people aspect, and that yeah. every day was different. And you weren't just sitting in an office all day, being bored, whatever, yeah. meeting new, interesting people. And then I turned 21 and I was in a position where I was like, I don't know. I feel like I was having a midlife crisis, but at 21, I thought, I really love real estate, but I had my first ever spray tan.
Yes.
And which I was forced to
you
have
never
by
forget
a friend.
Your first.
I do not. I still remember it vividly. And I had it because I'm very fair, but I do have tan on now, as you can see.
Kind of
and
late.
Really loved the spray tan, and then started getting them every week. And this, so many people think it's crazy when I say this, but I discovered that a tanning salon that my mum used to go to when I was a kid in Brighton, where we lived, was for sale. And I just had this like crazy whim, like, I want to buy this business. And I went home and my parents divorced, but I told both of them independently, and neither of them said, you're crazy or you shouldn't do this. They were very, very supportive. They were like,
love
you
that.
Know what? You're not going to lose the house over this. You're not going to starve. Just do it. And yeah, you know nothing about running a business and you know nothing about, beauty industry or anything, but anything that you do that you've ever done, you've always just like made it work. So anyway, bought this business, negotiated, bought it, and it was a tanning salon.
Yeah.
With sunbeds only. And I knew immediately that obviously that wasn't what I wanted it just to be. So got rid of half of those tanning beds. This was obviously a long time ago when they were legal. And we introduced spray tanning, lash extensions and waxing. So yeah. all quick in and out services in Brighton. You know, I knew a lot of people there and I was just the face of this salon, and I actually did a lot of the spray tanning. The ladies, very wasted on me, of course, seeing lovely ladies having a spray tan. But yeah, it just became this fad and it was a crazy success. So,
okay, so I have a few questions about this time. As I was reading this, I'm like, there's got to be more to it than just turning 21 and being like, oh, this seems like a fun idea. But no, that's pretty much how it was. Was it just like gut instinct?
It was, and I've certainly, my gut has served me well in my life, whether it be with people or business staff, work, whatever it may be. Mm. Look, everything, I know this might sound, fluffy, but like whatever will be,
yeah, and I love that.
Things are gonna, and like I've always had the mindset of I'd rather have regrets for doing than not doing.
Yeah.
Which is sometimes easier said than done. But I did almost wake up one morning and I just went on to businesssales.com or what, and found that this place was for sale. And I'm like, oh, I know that place, Tahiti on Church. It's not there anymore. That was, I don't know, it was crazy, but just did it. And I felt nervous and excited and sick to my stomach the whole time. Yeah. But like it was the right thing.
How did you go about like learning on the job, not just the job, but running the whole business? Like, was that?
It was a huge learning.
Yeah.
Because I bought it and there were already staff in it. And weirdly, I knew some of them. We went to primary school together. It was a great time. But obviously, over the 2.5 years that I had it, we had staff changes. And sure. I learned a lot about that and how to deal with staff and different people. Mm. And, I was so young and inexperienced back then. And then the whole business side and accounting and all of that, I just put myself, I said to my grandfather, I said, oh, can I speak to the accounting firm that he used for his 40 years in business? Can I go and speak to them? Can you organize? I just want to go in for a few hours and just learn the basics as to what I should be doing in order to make, their life easy. Because I also didn't want to be and wasn't in a position to be, hiring a bookkeeper or anything like that. Like I wanted a very self-sufficient business. Mm. And so you had to be smart with your money.
I mean, it's kind of universal. Hey, you can't just start a business and be like, okay, well, I'm going to hire this. Yes. There is an element of like, all right, I've just got to be scrappy here.
Correct. Yes, exactly.
This is probably a broad question, but on the beauty industry, you've entered it kind of on a whim. 15 years later, here you are, founder of a beauty brand, have been working in beauty ever since. What do you love about this industry?
That it's so diverse, ever-evolving. Trends can be crazy and fleeting, or they can be there for good or for a very long time. There's no necessarily right or wrong thing or idea.
Yeah.
And you can be really creative. I always say I'm not a very creative or imaginative person because I can't. Like, I don't think I'm a good marketer or, I can't dream up lovely designed things, although I did dream up
the bottles. I was about to say, I find this very hard to believe.
But I don't feel that way. Maybe I am. But, and I just love that it's fiercely competitive as well. Mm. And I love that. Like, I'm a very competitive person. And I also love being around people who are direct competitors in whatever space I'm in, because like we're not there to bring each other down. We're there to grow a category, grow awareness, grow a customer base, and so on. Mm. So it's got to be fun as well.
I love that. Okay, so you take the business, you move it more towards spray tanning. You become the number one stockist nationally of Tuscan Tan. They then poach you, as they should, when you are the number one stockist. You then worked for Tuscan Tan. You've worked for Mind Tan Body Skin 7-ish years at Bondi Sands.
Yeah.
Over that time, this is so funny for someone that was like, oh, the beauty industry, yeah, a bit of fun. And like, look at you. What are some lessons that you picked up over that time that you find you're still applying to your work now?
I would think, Firstly, never be afraid to ask for something.
Yep.
And that could be from a retailer, from a colleague, from a manufacturer, supplier. Because if you don't, I always say this, if you don't ask, you don't get. And so many times I've been told by, I remember at Bondi Sands, I was so fortunate to work with Sean and Blair, who are so entrepreneurial, and I'm very much like that. And we were all rubbed off on each other in that way, and so did like the rest of the leadership team and the wider team. And nothing was ever a no. Like, we were always just like, well, let's make it happen.
Mm.
So I think I also believe, and this is a quote from Kris Jenner, who says,
I'm going to love it.
If the answer is no, you're talking to the wrong person or you're asking the wrong person. So just find someone else. And that's so often the case. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly encountered no's many times. But you've got to just rethink the strategy or speak to someone else. And we were told at Bondi Sands, like, you know, did we achieve some amazing things? It was the ride of a lifetime. And so many people wouldn't even understand, but it was phenomenal and something that I'll always hold dear. But we were so frequently told by our distributors or external parties that, oh, no, you can't ask that question. You can't put that proposal forward to a retailer because that's not how they do it. And I'm like, but have we asked?
Yeah.
No. And I would say, and I know, so I can remember so many times, I'd say, well, if you don't want to ask, totally fine. You've got your reputation, whatever it may be. I'll ask.
Amazing.
And, you know, you put a compelling enough case forward or think outside the box. Like, you can't just keep doing things the same for decades and decades and decades and expect a different result.
Well, it's the very definition of, like,
yes,
madness.
Insanity.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. Doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't work.
Mm.
I love that. That is a great lesson. Okay, let's talk hairification. At what point did the idea for a hair care brand start to kind of ruminate?
Mm-hmm.
It's a saturated market. Was there a gap that you'd seen that you wanted to fill?
So the idea came about in 2020. I was in London before the pandemic and the world shut down, working on a big business transition for Bondi Sands.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that all kind of turned to a bit of a nightmare because of lockdown. And anyway, I came back, did the hotel quarantine, and I remember sitting in that hotel room at Crown Promenade, looking at my friends on the footpath who'd walk past every day and wave at me.
Oh, bless.
And I was like, I love my job and this brand, and I was so passionate about it and all-consuming, but I thought, I really do want to, you know, maybe do something else. Like, I felt restless in that moment.
Yeah.
And I saw another hair care brand enter the grocery space very successfully at the time, or appeared very successful, so, and I'm sure it was. And I thought,
without naming it, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, and I thought, this is really interesting because they've got their pretty packaging, quote unquote pretty packaging. Wasn't necessarily high quality or beautiful feeling, but it looked cute on the shelf and cute in the bathroom, and I totally got why people would buy it. The product, all of that aside, none of that mattered.
Yeah.
Because it was still selling, obviously. And I thought, yeah, this is an opportunity. I'd never thought hair care before, but I just thought, well, there's an opportunity clearly here. And also the grocers, they have a very clear strategy. And, you know, the CEO of Coles has, in the last 12 months, been very clear that their strategic focus in the health and beauty segment is to bring brands that are from the Meccas, Sephora's, Priceline, Kim's Warehouse, and bring them into the grocery aisle.
Yeah.
And I, you know, personally have no problem with that. I'm not so concerned about where any product of mine is sold, as long as it's accessible.
Yeah.
And so that's where I had this idea. And then obviously throughout lockdown, I'd always think about it and talk about it with friends, but just never really did anything, like didn't get over the hump. And then a couple of years later, in late 2022, I just by coincidence met my formulator of hairification, and we were talking and got along well. And I said to her, I said, hey, do you think you could make products for me that would do this and do that? And she said, oh, yeah, I'd love to do that. That sounds amazing. And she's made products for, I could name many of them and you'd know. And so she's really, really talented, her and her team. And I said, look, Simone, my only prerequisite here for this product is if we're going to say on the front of pack that it does something, it just has to do it.
Yeah.
Because I think, unfortunately, in the not even just beauty industry, just retail.
Yeah.
I know I'm a great salesperson, but I'm also can be sold to so easily.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I'm walking down the aisle or in a retailer and I pick up a product and it says it will do X, Y, Z, I just believe it because yeah. that's what it says. And I go, yeah, I'll buy that. And so many times, and I'm sure there's millions of other people out there too that have just been disappointed. And so I just wanted to deliver what we say we would. And we always did that at Bondi as well. So,
yeah. I love that. Okay, so where do you go from there? You've been sitting on the idea for like 2 to 3 years.
Mm.
You meet your formulator by chance.
Yep.
Then how long did the process take from having that conversation through to it being available? What steps did you have to take? Like, there's so much to
it. Yes, there is a lot. And look, luckily I already had a lot of experience and
knew
a lot of things, but still it was a tight timeline. So we started working on the product and the formulation and the concept, and I approached Coles, showed it to the buyers there who I'd known from, I'd worked with on previous categories as well. And they really loved it, which was great.
Yes.
And so we're in this position. So I believe it was kind of August timing. Simone and I had our first conversations and I gave her briefs and she was like, yeah, we can do this. Like, there's ingredients out there that I've wanted people to use, but they're not for whatever, because of price or whatever, or that people just haven't come to me saying, I want to formulate a product that does X, Y, Z. And I said, okay, great, we'll put it together. And then I remember I secured a meeting with Coles, and the week before the meeting, and it was like mid-December.
Yep.
We got some quotes back from a contract manufacturer as to how much it would cost just to make the fill.
Mm-hmm.
And look, they were eye-watering. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is going to die before it's even taken its first breath. And I was so deflated. But then I once again remembered, if the answer's no or it doesn't work, we're just talking to the wrong person.
Yeah.
So we just went somewhere else and we went somewhere else and we found out ways to reduce our costs, and it just turned out the people we were speaking to, they were just not the right fit anyway, not really experienced in mass FMCG production.
You know,
they had low MOQs of like 1,000 units, which was not what we wanted to do. And so we went somewhere else, and our manufacturer have been amazing to work with. I've dealt with so many contract manufacturers over the years, and these people are a new one I've never dealt with, and they've been phenomenal. And you know, we've cut costs by, I actually import and purchase a lot of the key actives that deliver our great claims in the products myself directly.
Amazing.
So we hold that, and our contract manufacturer draws down on them as and when they need. So that saves, because, you know, there's also a huge commerciality piece to this as well.
Massive.
I mean, we're in grocery, we're in Priceline. You have to be accessible at a starting recommended retail price and then be able to discount as well. So,
Forget about that.
So anyway, discussions August, met December. By January, it was all kind of confirmed. And then, like, June, July, we were shipping in. So it was very fast.
Wow.
Very fast.
Okay, wow. So did you launch straight into Coles?
Yes, we had no e-commerce. I'd not sold one unit. I'd not announced the brand.
Wow.
No one knew about it until we hit shelf, and we're in 840 Coles stores to begin with.
Did that present any challenges? Like, you've just mentioned, you know, finding someone who can work on the product that understands that it is mass.
Yeah.
Talk me through it. This is
lots of challenges.
840 stores off the bat is mind blowing.
Mm. Lots of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of times where I thought, this is not going to happen, and I'm going to have to move overseas and hide because yeah. I'll be just ashamed yeah. By the fact I haven't been able to deliver upon a dream I've sold.
Yeah.
But everything came off in the end. There were certainly times where I thought it wasn't going to. We just had delays with producing. So the packaging, for one, that's all custom molds. I drew the shape of the bottle. But then it's one thing to brief in something to a manufacturer overseas and they then generate a mold. It's not just boom like that. It takes 3 to 4 months and there's refining and this and it's a whole thing. And then there's everything else you have to do. But effectively, it was very fast, and whoever's listening and thinking, I'm inspired by what I'm hearing, or I've been thinking of doing this too, the caution I would give would be do not try to do it as fast as we did, because it was
very sound advice.
There was a lot of luck, a lot of relationship, a lot of prior knowledge, skill, money as well, which I think some people must think to start a brand, oh, it costs millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars. And then I think other people think, oh, it doesn't cost anything. And it's certainly somewhere in between the two, which is a lot for most people. So, it was definitely a struggle. So don't attempt it, even if you wanted to launch just one product on. I mean, I think probably some good advice would be to maybe produce products and slowly tease them out onto your e-com. Sure, you're not going to make as much money or profit to begin with, it will be slower, but you can refine really easily along the way. I couldn't.
Not when you're in 840 stores.
Oh, yeah. You know, our pipe filling to Coles was, you know, the number of units. We're talking six figures, number of units. So it's huge. But it all worked out.
Yeah. Well, it just got huger because last month it was announced that the brand is now also in all Priceline stores, of which there are 470, if research serves me, which not quick maths at all. I used a calculator. Means that the brand is now in 1,300 stores across Australia.
Yes, which is a bit of a pinch me moment.
It's incredible.
So many people say to me, which is really humbling, they're like, oh, you should be so proud. And I'm like, yeah, I am. But it's, you know, I've certainly done the selling and the rapid growth with Bondi Sands. We went from 470 Priceline stores in Australia to, in the end, 44,000 worldwide, which is probably one of the biggest success stories of an Australian health and beauty brand.
Totally.
And do I have the same aspirations? Yeah, similar. But I have been told that we are the fastest growing hair care brand in Australia at the moment from a distribution standpoint, number of doors, because, within less than 6 months, we've rolled out into Priceline as well as Coles, which is phenomenal. And both retailers, great partners, love them both. Sure, there's challenges. And if you've never dealt with a retailer before, I suggest you, if you're thinking about it, really talk to people who've done it, because it's a big thing. Just even getting ready, just having your products registered so they can place a purchase order is a huge process. Lots of learnings.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on that, obviously you had existing relationships because you'd been in the industry for so long and you'd done so much with Bondi Sands. Is there any advice that you can give to someone, not necessarily in beauty, but anyone who wants to get their brand in front of the decision makers at a major retailer?
Firstly, I would say look at, they could be competitors in the space you plan to enter or not, but brands or founders who already sell their products in those retailers, talk to them first, slide into their DMs. It happens to me all the time. Talk to them. I'm sure that most of them would be happy to have a coffee with you. And, you know, I'm always so happy for, I'd rather give people advice so they don't make, they're always going to make mistakes, but to avoid even just one mistake.
I think that surprises people that, I mean, from my experience talking to founders, the majority of people in the industry also believe that there is room for everyone.
Yeah.
There's how many people on earth, there's space.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Because without competitors,
exactly.
My brand is what? nothing, you know. You need competitors. You need to be kept on your toes as a brand, as a founder, as everything. You need, you also just need that breadth of range and that good, better, best offering on shelf everywhere, because every consumer is different every day of the week.
Of course.
But yeah, advice would be talk to people that have done it before. Don't, like, if you are lucky enough to get in contact with the right buyer and actually have them respond, because they're so busy and, you know, so their time is so preoccupied with their existing brands, and being a buyer is a big job. I see it and I'm like, ooh, I wouldn't want to do that. And if you're lucky enough to get that meeting, don't go in it blind, because there's so much that it'll be a great learning experience for you.
Yeah.
But you may very well just fall flat on your face. So speak to, and also you need to have a bit of an idea of, you know, the commercial side and how to build your brand and the marketing, whether it be, you know, the co-op side, direct with retailer, and then your above the line side of things, external, and there's a lot. So I definitely say try to get some advice from someone who's done it.
Because there's going to be questions thrown at you in that meeting that you may have never thought about.
Correct.
It sounds like the worst theatre sports exercise of all time.
Oh, yeah. And it happens to me still today. And I have met with retailers literally all over the world. And some of the toughest were certainly in the United States. And, you know, many times we've been in meetings and there's 10 people from the brand you're working with on the call, and you'll be asked a question, a really curly one, and everyone's sitting there not being able to answer, and the buck stopped with me. And so I would always, I was known as maybe the, I'll have an answer for everything.
You've got to. You absolutely have got to. Okay, so something that we've talked about on the podcast before, but I'm so fascinated by it, is customer conversion, particularly when you're launching into the supermarket space, because I would imagine the challenge with launching in that way is that a lot of your, like, grocery customers, if they're buying their hair care while they're doing the grocery shop, it's probably pretty habitual. They're probably just reaching for whatever they have bought forever, or, you know, whatever their wife has said, grab some shampoo or whatever it is. Not to generalize, but that's sort of how it goes. How have you gone about converting new Coles shoppers?
So I will say, in the lead up to being on shelf, there's all this rush and anxiety about, oh, we've got to deliver on time and, you know, have and then it hit the shelves and I had this moment of, I had a moment of relief, because I'm like, woo, we've delivered and, you know, this is great. And then I had this moment of, oh my gosh, and I didn't phrase it in my head that politely.
Yeah, sure.
What if no one wants to buy my product?
I was about to say, I can't imagine that moment of relief lasted for too long.
No, it didn't. It was like 3 seconds. And then I was like, oh, no. And I remember the first store I walked into and saw it on shelf, I, like, squealed with excitement. And then I'm standing there and I'm like, oh, there's a lot here. And I know that I'm filling a gap, but I'm quite high priced for who I'm sitting amongst.
Sure.
And what if people don't like the look of the packaging or the product or the smell or this, and obviously you're never going to please everyone, but that was a very sobering and an anxiety filled moment. But then I had to pinch myself and snap myself back into gear and say, hang on, you can't control what every single person who's walking through Coles looks, thinks and feels, nor would you want to. So you've just got to, once again, give it your best shot and put yourself in the best position to succeed, and make mistakes and learn. So converting customers, firstly, that distribution piece is key. Everyone goes to the supermarket because everyone got to eat.
Yes.
Being in a category that's very competitive, but also in an everyday use, high frequency use category, is one of the reasons why I went into hair care. And so you've got to get the shoppers when they're in store at the shelf. So I've invested a lot of money in doing things like point of sale, which is all Coles executed, point of sale on shelf with a bit of education, like why you should buy. You've also got to have the shelf-ready trays, which has, you know, a teeny little bit of cardboard where you can say, you know, this is a hair health hydrating shampoo or a mask or whatever. Okay. And then you have the whole, I have a digital agency who does all targeted ads, digital, social, Google, everything.
It's another language.
Trying to pick, oh yeah, it's another language for me too. That's why I have those people who just throw a lot of money at them. And, you know, them trying to target the Coles shopper. Then you've got the whole catalog side of things. Then when you can, you want to be on promotion to just drive trial and get product in people's hands. And I was always very confident in the product. I was very skeptical at first when our manufacturers and formulator came and said, okay, this is the final thing. You know, you've approved the fragrance, you've approved the feel. Da, da, da. And I'm like, and now does it work? And I have a very, very anal, fussy hairdresser. I say this to her face.
But also that's the... These are traits that one wants in a hairdresser, sure.
Yes, and I see her every 5 weeks because I'm not a natural blonde, which may shock you. For my on scalp, every 5 weeks. Anyway, I thought... I hadn't told her what I was doing because she's very, like... She's very, very knowledgeable, knows a lot. Anyway, so I went home after my hair being done, and for 5 weeks straight I used the Pure Grow shampoo and conditioner every day. And I thought, let's see if this actually works, because if someone's going to notice, it will be Colleen the hairdresser.
For sure.
So I walk into the salon 5 weeks later. The first thing she says to me, wow, your hair's grown a lot. And look, I'm not challenged in that space anyway, thank goodness, touch wood. And I said, oh yeah, it hasn't. She's like, oh, you've got all this new growth like around your temples and on your part there. And I said, oh yeah, cool. And then, you know, my 4 hour journey, you know, progresses, and she says, oh, your scalp's really pink. I'm like, oh, what does that mean? And she says, well, it means you've got great circulation and it's very healthy. And then finally she said, oh, and you've got all this new growth I can see at the back of your head.
New growth from someone doing my hair is, oh.
Yeah. Excellent. And also hearing you don't have any grays. People say to me, you wouldn't know. And I'm like, I would know. She would tell me.
Yeah, for sure.
And so she, I said, okay, I've got a level with you. And I like pulled the like pre-production samples out of my bag. And I was like, this is what I've done. And she was like, wow, okay, yeah, can confirm, works.
Love it.
So, and then there's the testimonials from all, from customers. And so I was always confident.
My wedding hairdresser saying, hey, can you maybe just chill out a little bit, because your hair's really healthy and I actually need it to be a little bit disgusting.
Yes, for exactly. It's dirty, kind of a bit, you know, have a bit of grip to it. So, yeah, it's I was always confident in the product, and I knew that if people just tried it, they'd, most people, 99.99% of people are like, I love the fragrance in it.
Literally the first thing I said to you today, it's so good.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, so so it's not easy, but you've got to come at it at all angles, you know, even the influencer marketing side of things. TikTok is obviously huge, and I have a great team of people who are just like crazy creatives who I'm just like, I could never think of that. And unfortunately, I am in some of the TikToks.
You have to be at this point.
Oh, I know. And I'm just like, I don't need to be. And they're like, well, we could try. So, anyway, there's a whole, you'll have to have a watch, because there's this whole thing about my hair and, you know, being, is it fake? Because it's, you know, is the quiff, if the quiff is not on a 45 degree angle, it's going to be a bad day. Lots of this funny stuff.
I love this.
So yeah, you've really got to come in at all angles. It's not cheap to do that, but you really have to reinvest. And I believe that if you really want to get your brand off the ground, do not be afraid. Sorry, be prepared to spend 30 to 40% of your turnover on marketing. And that is everything marketing. Yeah. That's your co-op with your retailer, influencer, ads, everything. At least that. I probably spend more.
I really appreciate you, though, touching on how you do need to come at it from all angles, even, you know, the display in store, because it would just be so... I mean, you can't just be like, how do you convert customers? Oh, the product's really good. Okay, great, but like...
I have to buy it.
Yeah, it doesn't work like that. So there's so much to it.
Yeah.
You launched with 6 SKUs across 2 ranges.
Yes.
pure growth, which you were just talking about, and pure health, which is
what you've experienced.
Yes, mad for it. How did you decide which products to launch with?
Well, I always knew we wanted to do something with the whole growth angle because there was nothing in grocery when we first went to Coles. There was nothing in grocery. Yeah. There were other brands that were in the pharmacy space and then higher end space.
Yep.
And I knew and was quite confident that that's a subcategory that grocery would want to dive into.
Mm.
So there was that piece. And also, look, there were reasons why I wanted to develop that. Firstly just have a product that we had some good claims that you could substantiate and that proof in the pudding that it worked for people. And then the health / hydration range, really just wanted to service a very broad demographic of people who wash their hair. A lot of people have great heads of hair and they think, oh, I don't need extra growth, but you still want to protect it from heat, reduce the rate that it naturally falls out, protect it from colouring and just environmental factors, increased keratin synthesis, all of those things. So just very kind of more general, but still some great call-out results in there as well. So
I could be wrong, but just based on everything that you've done thus far, I would imagine that maybe there are some other products and little things in the works, in which case, again, correct me if I'm wrong, how does that product development process work for you? Are you always thinking about what might come next, or are you working off what consumers are asking for, or is it a bit of both?
Certainly a bit of both. I believe product development, you want to have the innovation piece.
Mm-hmm.
But innovation is very difficult to deliver and actually then translate to sell through. Because sometimes it can be innovation that's so far reaching that maybe I get it and understand, but everyone else doesn't. Then there's the piece of what is working well and driving growth in a category at the moment, and how can we better that, or how can we deliver upon or amalgamate that with some innovation as well, and jam it all together, I guess. The first people I ask is the retailers. I say, tell me, where do you see growth in your category? Where do you see gaps? Where do you see opportunity? And they're always quite forthcoming. Love those conversations. I was, down on the peninsula on the weekend and there was a Priceline there, and I'm like, everyone with a group of friends, I'm like, we're going into Priceline. And most of the time people just roll their eyes at me. But I have all my family and friends not on the payroll at all. They just get free product. They must go in and straighten up those shelves. But I love going into retailers, grocers all over the world. In Australia, it's like my porn. I just love it. I love just looking at everything and, what's new, and I wonder why they did that. And so that's where a lot of ideas and inspiration and innovation comes from, because, hairification, the name was, which I did think of, which, wow, did that take a long time? Because finding something that you can trademark is, I can think of many things, but you can't trademark them.
Correct.
So hairification, I thought, is the skinification of hair care. And I know that's a term that's thrown around a lot these days. And I wanted to deliver something that's really super efficacious in the hair care category. Because, hey, skincare has been super. La Roche-Posay did it so well. Mm-hmm. And still do it really, really well across sun care, skin care, body care. So many other brands do it well. And consumers, they want that multi-benefit, all in one, better, better, better all the time. So
they're so savvy now, and that's just going up and up and up.
Yes, yes, indeed. So, the product innovation. And then sometimes I just think of things like, hey, this could be good. Could we make it? And then it's a conversation with manufacturers and formulator and everything. So,
well, that's kind of how the brand came to be. You've gone, here's a thought.
Yes.
Let's make it happen. I do want to briefly touch on your work with Gem.
Yeah.
We had Georgia on the podcast last season. God, I love her. She was so pregnant.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
You are Director of Global Sales and Commercial Strategy at GEM. Product offering aside, what have been the differences and perhaps the surprising similarities, if you will, between a hair care brand versus oral care?
Mm-hmm. Oral care and hair care, the similarities are that they're a high frequency of use product.
Yeah.
I would hope everyone brushes their teeth every day, and I'd hope people wash their hair at least every second day or every day. So those high frequency, obviously very competitive and saturated categories. And oral care, I think probably a bigger difference in that space to hair would be that you have people, I know myself, before GEM, I ingrained in me since a child, we've always used Colgate.
Well, I think that was when I was saying before about converting the Coles customer, I think it was Georgia that I had that conversation with, because oral care more than anything is like, this is the packaging that I know, and into my cart it goes.
Correct. And I first met with Georgia about GEM, and I certainly had some thoughts about, you know, where the brand could go and what could happen. And it's been amazing in a very short time. Like, we've, you know, tripled the size of the business, gone global. It's phenomenal. Similarities in the whole area of wanting to break up, especially in oral care, wanting to deliver that beautification of, you know, of oral care, and having,
I get it,
because so many other categories, you know, hair care, again, I wanted to deliver packaging that was different, clean, clinical, not offensive in the shower, in anyone's bathroom. But then our tone of voice is fun, because that's, you know, I'm cheeky, rude, whatever, fun. So, and then the oral care side, no one's ever delivered anything that's pretty that you would want to put on your bathroom.
It has never been about experience of use. It's just about, like, doing the thing, ticking it off the list.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So yeah, it's that would be some similarities, but two very different categories, but some similarities still.
You've been a part of the beauty industry for the last 15 or so years. Over the last few years, what have been some of the biggest changes that you have seen within the beauty space?
Super aware consumers.
Yeah.
Well-read, well-researched.
Mm-hmm.
And that demand, not even demand, that expectation from consumers, which I think is great, that their products need to be effective. They need to hit a lot of touch points, whether that be sustainability piece or, you know, completely recyclable packaging piece, and high level of active ingredients or quality ingredients or Australian made or whatever it may be. There's a lot of demand out there from those consumers. Changes, well, I think things have just gotten better, and so many brands out there, and I love looking, and I watch so many brands, and I look at so many of them, and I think, ah, that's so beautiful, or I love that look and style, and I wish I could do that my own or have that idea. I just love watching that evolution. And there are so many brands out there as well, like over the last 15 years, who, you know, they've come to market, they've died, they've been resurrected, and now bigger than ever.
Mm.
And, you know, then there's the whole, I guess, dupe culture at the moment, which is, a hot topic.
We could do a whole bonus episode on that alone.
Exactly. So, you know, a lot going on, but there's a lot of consumers, a lot of different needs, and I think that at the moment it's broader than ever, more diverse than ever, and that's amazing.
Are there any changes that you think we can expect to see over the next few years?
I think it'd be interesting to see where the dupe culture goes. But also where, you know, there's a lot of VC and PE money out there at the moment who are investing into brands. A lot of them, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And then there's also, you know, the big beauty houses like the L'Oreals and Estées of the world that are splashing out and buying these brands like, you know, Aesop, yeah. for example, that have, which has been such an amazing Australian beauty brand story over decades. And it's like, I wonder what will, you just hope, I hope that that those brands continue to flourish and be who they are yeah. and not go the other way.
That merger was announced the day that I got my, just to digress, the day I got my wisdom teeth pulled out. And as I was going under, you know how they're like trying to distract you and yes. have a chat, one of the nurses goes, oh, so you work in beauty. Did you hear about L'Oreal acquiring Aesop? And then I've fallen asleep. And then when I came to, I'm in a different room.
Is that
and I'm
a like, dream?
I know I've gone, it's actually pronounced Aesop. And there's a totally different nurse standing next to me. And she's like, oh, you, you're awake.
Oh, so you're not in pain.
So I know the exact timeline of that. All right, final question. What is next for hairification?
Global domination. We will be going international this year, which
That's
is exciting.
Amazing.
Big international. So I've, very exciting. We're working on that at the moment, which again, and then also new products as well. So new exciting products, range extensions. So there's a lot that we've developed because I believe it's important to be ready with things so speed to market can be delivered upon. I think new products and entering more than one international market is probably enough for 2024 for Jordan.
That was Jordan Mylius, founder of Hairification, which you can find on Instagram at hairification_haircare. To read more, you can visit glowjournal.com. And for more beauty news, you can find me on Instagram at gemdiamond or at glow.journal. If you liked this episode, please do not forget to subscribe, rate, review, and share so other beauty and business lovers can find us. I'm Gemma Diamond. You've been listening to the Glow Journal podcast, and thank you for joining me. The Glow Journal podcast would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional custodians of the land upon which this podcast is produced. We pay our respects to elders past and present.